Timescape, Cassette 4.
Damn streets, Kiefer complained. Getting like a slum.
He wrenched the steering wheel around a sharp curve. Tires howled. For Peterson, this change of topic was a decided improvement. Kiefer had been reciting the virtues and benefits of eating fresh vegetables, brought in at something approximating the speed of light, from the valley, a cornucopia needing no further name. To encourage this new line of discussion, Peterson ventured mildly, "It all looks very prosperous to me."
"Yes, well, of course, you don't see it if you keep to the avenues, but it's getting harder to maintain standards. Look around you here, for instance. Notice anything?"
They were high in the hills now, on winding narrow roads that afforded glimpses of the ocean between Spanish ranches and miniature French chateau.
"See how they're walled in? When we first came here, oh, almost 20 years ago now, they were all open. Great views from every house. Now you can't even call on your neighbor without standing out in the street pushing buttons and talking into an intercom. And Frapp, you should see the anti-burglar networks. Electronics worth 100 German shepherds. Backup batteries for brownouts, too."
"The crime rate is that bad, then?" Peterson asked.
"Terrible. Illegal aliens. Too many people, not enough jobs. Everyone feels he has a right to a life of luxury, or at least comfort. So there's a lot of frustration and resentment when the dream craps out."
Peterson began to replan his schedule. He would leave time to find the best electronic security system he could. Stupid of him not to think of it before. That sort of thing was precisely where the Americans excelled. He would have use for a good system, adaptable and rugged. If possible, he would carry it back with him on the plane. Again, he wished for a private jet.
"The town is getting carved up into sealed-off enclaves," Kiefer went on. "Oldsters, mostly."
Peterson nodded as Kiefer cited statistics for California, which were second only to Florida in percentage of old people. Since the fold-up of the Social Security system, the senior movement lobby had been pressuring even harder for special privileges, tax breaks, and extra favors. Peterson was sure he knew more of the demographics than Kiefer. The council had got a worldwide picture on them 2 years ago, including some confidential projections. Attaining the zero population growth birth rate had left the U.S. and Europe with a bulge in the population curve, now hitting retirement age. They expected hefty monthly checks, which had to come from the reduced ranks of younger people through taxes. It led to an entitlement syndrome. The old felt they had paid heavy taxes all along, and then been put on the shelf before they could earn the immense salaries now going to junior executives. They were entitled, the senior movement argued, and society had damn well better cough up. The oldsters voted more often, and with a sharper eye for self-interest. They had power. In California, a grey head had become a symbol of political activism.
"They don't come out for weeks with the spiffy tele-video systems they buy. Save them shopping or going to the bank or seeing anybody under 60. They just do it all electronically. Kills the town, though. The oldest movie theatre in La Jolla, The Unicorn, closed last month. Damn shame."
Peterson nodded with a show of interest, still thinking about rearranging his schedule. The car swung into a steep driveway as the gate opened before it. They climbed up towards a long, white house. "Bastard Spanish," Peterson classified silently. "Expensive, but without style." Kiefer parked in the carport, and Peterson noticed bicycles in the wagon. Christ. Children. If he had to share the dinner table with a crew of American brats. It looked as though his fears were going to be realized, when they were met at the door by two young boys jumping at Kiefer and both talking at once. Kiefer managed to quiet them down long enough to introduce them to Peterson. Both children then trained their attention on him. The older boy dispensed with preliminaries and asked directly,
"Are you a scientist like my dad?"
The younger fixed him with an unwinking stare, shifting from foot to foot in an irritating way. Of the two, he was potentially the noisier and more troublesome, Peterson decided. He knew the older boy's type. Earnest, talkative, opinionated, and nearly uncrushable.
"Not exactly," he began, but was interrupted. "My dad is studying diatoms in the ocean," the boy said, dismissing Peterson. "It's very important. I'm going to be a scientist too when I grow up, but maybe an astronomer, and David's going to be an astronaut, but he's only 5, so he doesn't really know. Would you like to see the model of the solar system I made for our science project?
No, no, Bill, Kiefer answered hastily. I know it's very nice, but Mr. Peterson doesn't want to be bothered now. We're going to have a drink and talk about grown-up things.
He led the way to the living room, followed by Peterson and the two boys. Kiefer would be the sort of parent who called adults grown-ups, Peterson thought dryly.
I can talk about grown-up things too, Bill said indignantly.
Yes, yes, of course you can. What I meant was, we're going to talk about things that wouldn't interest you. What'll you have to drink? Can I offer you a whiskey and soda, wine, tequila?
How do you know they wouldn't interest me? Lots of things interest me, the child persisted before Peterson could answer.
The situation was saved by a light, firm voice calling from another room.
Boys, come here at once, please.
The two vanished without argument. Peterson stored for future use the verbal backhand he had been about to deal the older boy.
I see you have some Pernod there. Could I have a Pernod and tequila with a dash of lemon, if you please?
Jeez, what a mixture.
Is it good? I don't often drink hard liquor myself. Liver, you know. Sit down. I'm pretty sure we have some lemon juice. My wife will know. Does that drink have a name, or did you invent it?
Kiefer was acting erratically again.
I believe it's called a macho, Peterson said wryly.
He looked around the room. It was simple and elegant, totally white except for a few oriental pieces. An exquisite screen stood against the far wall. To the right of the fireplace was a Japanese scroll, and a flower arrangement sat in an alcove. Opposite the fireplace, uncurtained picture windows looked over roofs and treetops towards the Pacific. The ocean was a black blanket beside lights that glittered everywhere else up and down the coast, as far as Peterson could see. He chose a seat on a low white sofa, sitting sideways at the end of it, so he could see both the room and the view. In spite of little heaps of muddled papers here and there, obviously Kiefer's, the room exuded a certain serenity.
I hope this is right. Equal amounts of Pernod and tequila. Is that it? I'll go and check on the lemon juice. Here's my wife now.
Peterson turned towards the doorway, looked, and looked again. He rose slowly to his feet. Kiefer's wife stunned him. Japanese, young, slender, and very beautiful. Not taking his eyes from her, he tried to sort out his first disoriented impressions. In her late 20s, he decided, which explained Kiefer's having such young children.
A second marriage for him, no doubt. She was dressed in white Levi's and a high-necked white top of some slithery material. Nothing under it, he noted with approval. Her hair fell smooth and straight, almost to her waist, so black it seemed to have a blue sheen. But it was her eyes that riveted his attention. Seeing her in all white in this dimly lit white room, he had the eerie sensation that her head was floating by itself. She had paused in the doorway, not deliberately for effect, Peterson thought, but her appearance was dramatic. He felt unable to move until she did. Kiefer darted nervously forward.
Mitsuoko, my dear, come in, come in. I want you to meet our guest, Ian Peterson. Peterson, this is my wife, Mitsuoko.
He looked eagerly from one to the other, like a child bringing home a prize.
She came forward into the room, moving with a fluid grace that delighted Peterson. She held out her hand to him, cool and smooth.
Hello, she said.
For once, Peterson felt he could use the standard American greeting, glad to meet you, with sincerity.
He murmured, how do you do?
Narrowing his eyes slightly to communicate what his formal greeting lacked. The merest hint of a smile lifted the corners of her lips at his unspoken message. Their gazes held fractionally longer than convention dictated. Then she withdrew her hand from his and went over to sit on the sofa.
Do we have any lemon juice, honey?
Kiefer was rubbing his hands together in his awkward way.
And what about you? Will you have something to drink?
Yes, to both questions, she answered. There's some lemon juice in the fridge, and I have a little white wine. She turned to Peterson with a smile.
I can't drink much at all. It goes straight to my head. Kiefer left the room in search of lemon juice.
"How are things in England, Mr. Peterson?" she asked, tilting her head back slightly. "It sounds grim in the news here."
"It is bad, although a lot of people don't yet realize how bad," he replied.
"Do you know England?" "I was there for a year a while back. I'm very fond of England."
"Oh, were you working there?"
"I was on a postdoc at Imperial College in London. I'm a mathematician. I teach at UCSD now."
She was smiling as she watched him, expecting a reaction of surprise. Peterson didn't show it.
"I can see you expected something like a philosophy degree."
"Oh, no, nothing so conventional," he said smoothly, smiling back at her.
He thought of philosophers as people who spent great swathes of time on questions of no more true depth than, if there is no God, then who pulls up the next Kleenex? He was about to form this into an epigram when Kiefer came back into the room with a glass of wine and a small bottle.
"Here's your wine, love, and some lemon juice," this to Peterson.
"How much? Just a dash?"
"That's splendid, thank you."
Kiefer sat down and turned to Peterson.
"Did Mitsuoko tell you she'd spend a year at London University? She's a brilliant woman, my wife. PhD at 25. Brilliant and beautiful, too. I'm a lucky man."
He beamed proudly at her.
"Alex, don't do that."
The words were sharp, but her affectionate smile took the edge off them. She shrugged deprecatingly towards Peterson.
"It's embarrassing. Alex is always boasting about me to his friends."
"I can understand why." Behind Peterson's blandly smiling exterior, he calculated. He had only one evening. Did they have an open marriage? How direct an approach would she tolerate? How to broach the subject with Kiefer there?
"Your husband tells me that things are pretty bad here too, although it doesn't look that way to a visitor."
What did her smile mean? It was almost as though they shared a secret. Was she, in fact, reading his thoughts? Was she merely flirting? Or could it be, the thought flashed upon him, that she was nervous? She was certainly sending him signals.
"There's a psychological inability to give up luxury standards," Kiefer was saying. "People won't give up a lifestyle that they think is uniquely American."
"Is that a current catchphrase?" Peterson asked. "I saw it used in a couple of magazines I read on the plane." Kiefer gave this hypothesis his best concerned frown.
Uniquely American. Yeah, I suppose it is. Saw an editorial about something like that this week. Oh, say, excuse me, I'll go and check on the boys."
Kiefer left the room in his eager terrier style. In a moment, Peterson could hear him talking mildly but firmly to the boys somewhere down the hall. They regularly interrupted him with tenor-bright boy aware that he's being bright back-talk. Peterson took a pull on his drink and reflected on the wisdom of proceeding further with Mitsuoko. Kiefer was a link in Peterson's information-gathering chain, the most essential part of an executive's working machinery. This was indeed California, notorious California, and the date was well advanced beyond the 19th century. But one could never be sure how a husband would react to these things, never mind what they said in theory about the whole matter. But beyond such calculations was the fact that the man irritated him with his fanaticism about health foods and non-smoking and undignified devotion to those decidedly unpleasant children. Well, executives were supposed to be able to make quick, incisive decisions, correct?
Correct.
He turned to Mitsuoko, seeking the best way to use these moments alone. She was staring out at the view, which she must have memorized ages ago. Before he could formulate an opening, she asked, not looking at him, "Where are you staying, Mr. Peterson?"
"La Valencia, and the name is Ian."
"Ah, yes. There's a nice strip of beach there, south of the cove. I often take a walk there in the evenings." She looked directly at him.
"About 10 o'clock.
"I see," Peterson replied. He felt a pulse beating in his neck. It was the only outward sign of excitement. By God, she had done it.
She had made an assignation with him almost under her husband's nose. Christ, what a woman. Kiefer came back into the room.
There's a growing crisis here, he said.
Peterson gave a snort of laughter, which he deftly turned into a cough.
I think you're right,
he managed dryly. He dared not look at Mitsuyoko. On the long flight over the pole, Peterson had time to browse through the file from Caltech. He felt relaxed and pleasantly dissipated, with the slack sensation one gets when he knows he has done quite as much as could be expected along the lines of self-indulgence. No regrets, that was the ticket. It meant one had passed up nothing. To reach the grave with that assurance would surely be at least comforting. Mitsuoko had rather lived up to the subliminal advance billing. She had cleared off after 3 hours, presumably with some solid story, or better, a tacit agreement of no questions from Kiefer. A suitable topping off for a wearing trip. The Caltech file was something else. There were some grimly detailed internal reports, all a tangle of words and mathematical symbols to him. Markham could frolic in it if he liked. There were signs that the file hadn't been freely given over. A Xerox of an official letter, Peterson inspired, backgrounding for the council, had scrawled at the bottom, "Stall them, let's not get scooped." Surely the author of the note would have lifted that out before making it semi-public. The explanation was obvious. The American government had quite effective internal security people. Rather than trade letters with Caltech, they clandestinely photographed whatever they could turn up. Peterson sighed. A dicey method, but then again, not his problem. The only intelligible portion of the file was a personal letter, presumably stuck in because of key words. Dear Jeff, I'm not going to make it down for Easter. There's just too much to do here at Caltech. The last few weeks have been extremely exciting. I'm working with a couple of other people, and we really don't want to break off our calculations, even for a holiday in Baja. I'm really sorry about it, as I was looking forward to getting together with you both again, if you take my meaning. I shall miss the prickly cactus and the delicious dry heat, too. Sorry, and maybe next time. Tell Linda I'll call her for a chat in the next few days if I can find time. Any chance of you people coming up here for a day, or better yet, a night? After breaking a promise like this, I suppose I ought to tell you what stirred me up so. Probably a marine biologist like you won't think this is of such great concern. Cosmology doesn't count for a lot in the world of enzymes and titrated solutions and all that, I suppose. But to those of us working in the gravitational theory group, it looks as though there's a genuine revolution round the corner. Or maybe it's already arrived. It's related to a problem that's been hanging around astrophysics for a long time. If there's a certain quantity of matter in the universe, then it has a closed geometry, which means it will eventually stop expanding and begin to contract, pulled back together by gravitational attraction. So people in our line of work have been wondering for some time if there's enough matter in our universe to close off the geometry. So far, direct measurements of the matter in our universe have been inconclusive. Well, just counting the luminous stars in the universe gives a small quantity of matter, not enough to close off space-time. But there's undoubtedly a lot of unseen mass, such as dust, dead stars, and black holes. We're pretty sure that most galaxies have large black holes at their centers. That accounts for enough missing matter to close off our universe. What's new is the recent data on how distant galaxies are bunched up together. These galactic-scale clumps mean there are large fluctuations in matter density throughout our universe. If galaxies bunch up together somewhere in our universe, and their density gets high enough, their local space-time geometry could wrap around on itself in the same way that our universe might be closed. We now have enough evidence to believe Tommy Gold's old idea that there are parts of our universe which have enough clustered galaxies to form their own closed geometry. They won't look like much to us, just small areas with weak red light coming out of them. The red is from matter still falling into those clumps. The shocker here is that these local density fluctuations qualify as independent universes. The time for forming a separate universe is independent of the size. It goes like the square root of gn, where g is the gravitational constant and n the density of the contracting region. so it's independent of the size of the mini-universe. A small universe will close itself off just as fast as a large one. This means all the various-sized universes have been around for the same amount of time. Defining just what time is in this problem will drive you to drink if you're not a mathematician. Maybe if you are, too. The point here is that there may be closed-off universes inside our own. In fact, it would be a remarkable coincidence if our universe was the largest of all. We may be a local lump inside somebody else's universe. Remember the old cartoon of a little fish being swallowed by a slightly larger one, in turn about to be swallowed by another bigger one, and so on ad infinitum. Well, we may be one of those fishes. The last few weeks I've been working on the problem of getting information about or out of these universes inside our own. Clearly light can't get out of one universe into the next, neither can matter. That's what a closed geometry means. The only possibility might be some type of particle that doesn't fit into the constraints set by Einstein's theory. There are several candidates like this, but Thorne, the grand old man around here, doesn't want to get into that morass. Too messy, he says. I think tachyons are the answer. They can escape from the smaller universes inside our own. So the recent discovery of tachyons has enormous implications for cosmology. It's hard to detect tachyons, so we don't know much about them. They give us a direct link to the sealed-off space-times inside our universe, though, which is why I'm working so hard on the problem. There's a chance of a first-class discovery in this. We have the devil of a time pursuing things with a food strike and the big fire in L.A. Probably nobody will give much of a damn with the world in its present state, but that's what the academic life is for. I'm sorry I've gone on about this at such length and probably made no sense, but the whole thing is tremendously exciting to me, and I tend to get carried away. Anyway, I'm sorry about Baha. Hope to see you both soon. Love, Kathy. Peterson felt a momentary twinge of guilt at reading a private letter. The council used such methods routinely now, of course, to get quickly round the interests who had not accepted the necessity for quick action. Still, he was a gentleman, and a gentleman does not read another's mail. His reluctance soon submerged beneath his interest in the implications of what was said by Kathy. Sub-universes? Incredible. The landscape of the scientist was ultimately unreal. Peterson leaned back in his seat and studied Canadian waste slipping by below. Yes, perhaps that was it. For decades now, the picture of the world painted by the scientists had become strange, distant, unbelievable. Far easier then to ignore it than try to understand. Things were too complicated. Why bother? Turn on the telly, love. Right.
Chapter 12. December 3rd, 1962. Cooper laid the red gridded sheets out in a long line across the lab countertop. He stood back, balancing on his toes like a sprinter preparing to go the distance, and surveyed his work. The subdued hum of the laboratory underlined the expectation in the air. "That's it," Cooper said slowly. "They're in the right order." "That's our best data," Gordon murmured. "Best I'll ever get," Cooper said, frowning at something in Gordon's voice. He turned, hands on hips. "It's all consecutive, too. 3 hours worth." "It looks good and clean," Gordon said in a conciliatory tone. "Sharp." "Yeah," Cooper admitted. "Nothing funny about this. If there was a clear resonance there, I'd see it." Gordon traced his fingers along the green data lines. There were no standard resonances at all. Inside their sample, cooled down to 3 degrees absolute in the bubbling helium, were atomic nuclei, magnet. They tended to line up along the magnetic applied to the sample. The standard experiment was simple. Apply a brief electromagnetic pulse which tipped the nuclear magnets away from the magnetic field. In time, the nuclei would line up with the field again. This nuclear relaxation process could tell the experimenter much about the environment inside the solid. It was a relatively simple way to learn about microscopic features of the complex solid structure. Gordon liked the work for its clarity and directness, aside from any applications to transistors or infrared detectors it might eventually have. This branch of solid-state physics didn't have the high visibility of things like quasars or high-energy particle research, but it had beauty. The jagged traces before him, though, were neither simple nor beautiful. Here and there were fragments of what they should be getting. Nuclear resonance curves, smooth and meaningful. But in most of the gridded traces, there were sudden jagged line bursts of electromagnetic noise, appearing abruptly for an instant, then disappearing just as suddenly. "The same spacings," Gordon murmured. "Yeah," Cooper said. "The 1 centimeter ones," he pointed, "and the shorter ones, half a centimeter. Regular as hell." Both men looked at each other, then back at the data. Each had hoped for a different result. They had done these experiments over again and again, eliminating all possible sources of noise. The ragged bursts would not vanish. "It's a goddamn message," Cooper said. "Must be." Gordon nodded, fatigue seeping through him. "There's no avoiding it," he said. "We've got hours of signal here. Can't be coincidence. Not this much." "No." "Okay, then," Gordon said, summoning up optimism in his voice. "Let's decode the fucking thing." Reduction of oxygen content to below 2 parts per million within 50 kilometer radius of source after diatom bloom manifests AEMRUDYCO PEZQUEASKL. Minor pollutants present in Dietrich polixotrope 174A. 174A combines in latitine chain with herbicides Springfield AD45 or DuPont Analogan 58 emitting from repeated agricultural use Amazon basin, other sites, other long-chain molecular synergists possible in tropical environs, oxygen column subject to convective spreading rate, ALZSNRUD, ASMA, WSUEXIO, 829, CMXDROQ, virus imprinting stage results 3, 3-week delay if density of Springfield AD45, AD45, exceeds 158 parts per million, then enters molecular simulation regime, begins imitating host, can then convert plankton neurojacket into its own form using oxygen content, WTESJDKU, again, AMMA, ultraviolet sunlight on chains appears to retard diffusion in surface layers of the ocean, but growth continues lower down despite convective cells forming which tend to mix layers in XMC, AHSU, urgent, MADUDLO 374, only segment, AMZLSOUDP, ALYN. You must stop above named substances from entering ocean life chain. AMZSUY, RDUCDK, by prohibitions of following substances. Calanan, B471, 471, Mestophyte Salin Marine Compound, Alpha through Delta, YDEMCLW, urgent, YXU, conduct titration analysis on metastable ingredients PWMXSJR, ALSUDNCH. Gordon had no chance to think about the message until the afternoon. His morning was filled out by a lecture and then a committee meeting on graduate student admissions. There were top-flight students applying from all over. Chicago, Caltech, Berkeley, Columbia, MIT, Cornell, Princeton, Stanford. The canonical seats of wisdom. A few unusual cases. 2 odd ones from Oklahoma who might be promising. A gifted and quiet fellow from Long Beach State, were put aside for study. It was plain that La Jolla's fame was spreading rapidly. In part, it was the continuing heady rush of the Sputnik phenomenon. Gordon was writing himself, and he knew it. These were ripe times for science. He wondered, though, about the students just now coming into physics. Some of them seemed like the same sort that went into law or medicine, not because it was a fascinating subject, but because it promised big bucks. Gordon wondered privately whether Cooper had elements of that. The man showed sparks of the old flame, but it lay hidden beneath a blanket of mellow relaxation, an aura of physical assurance. Even the message, the very existence of a message, struck Cooper as a little funny, but basically acceptable, an odd effect soon to be explained. Gordon could not tell whether this was a pose or genuine serenity. Either way, it was unsettling. Gordon was used to a more intense style. He envied the physicists who had made the great discoveries when quantum mechanics was unfolding, when the nucleus first shattered. The older members of the department, Eckert and Lieberman, talked of those days sometimes. Before the 1940s, a degree in physics was a solid basis for a career in electrical engineering, period. The bomb had changed all that. In the avalanche of gaudy weapons, new fields of study, increased budgets, and expanding horizons, everyone discovered suddenly a national thirst for physicists. In the years following Hiroshima, a newspaper story referring to a physicist invariably called him the brilliant nuclear physicist, as though there could be no other kind. Physics got fatter. Even so, physicists were still relatively poorly paid. Gordon could remember a visiting professor at Columbia borrowing money to attend the Friday Chinese lunch Li and Yang had started up. The lunches met in one of the excellent Chinese restaurants ringing the campus, and it was there that new results often surfaced first. Attendance was a good idea if you wanted to keep up, so the visiting scholar had scrounged enough to go and paid it back within a week. Such days seemed distant to Gordon now, though they must loom large in the minds of the older physicists, he realized. Some, like Lakin, carried an air of uneasy waiting, as though the bubble would soon burst. The dazed public, with its short attention span, would be distracted by the cornucopia of tail fins and ranch-style tract homes and forget about science. The easy equation, science equals engineering equals consumer yummies, would fade. Physics had spent more time at the bottom of the S-curve than chemistry. World War I was the flush time for them, and now was enjoying the steep climb. But a plateau had to follow. The S-curve had to curl over. Gordon mulled this over as he made his way from the laboratory up the outside stairs to Lakin's office. The lab notebooks were carefully organized, and he had checked over the decoding of the message repeatedly. Still, he was of half a mind to turn around and avoid seeing Lakin at all. He was only a few sentences into his presentation when Lakin said, "Really, Gordon, I had trusted you would fix this trouble by now." "Isaac, these are the facts."
"No."
The trimly built man got up from behind his desk and began to pace. "I have looked into your experiment in detail. I read your notes. Cooper showed me where they were."
Gordon frowned.
"Why not ask me for them?"
"You were in class, and, I speak frankly, I wanted to see Cooper's own entries, in his own hand."
"Why?"
"You admit you did not take all the data by yourself."
"No, of course not. He's got to do something for a thesis."
"And he is behind schedule, yes?" "Significantly behind."
Lakin stopped and made one of his characteristic movements, dipping his head slightly and raising his eyebrows as he looked at Gordon, as though gazing over the rims of non-existent eyeglasses. Gordon supposed this was a glance meant to convey something unprovable but obvious, an unspoken understanding between colleagues.
"I don't think he's faking it, if that's what you mean," he said very steadily, keeping inflection out of his voice with some effort.
"How could you tell?" "The data I took fits in with the syntax of the rest of the message.
That could be a deliberate effect, somehow cooked up by Cooper."
Lakin turned toward the wind clasp behind his back, his voice now carrying a shade of hesitation.
"Come on, Isaac.
Lakin suddenly rounded on him. "Very well. You tell me, then, what is going on," he said crisply. "We have an effect, but no explanation. That's what's going on. Nothing more." He waved the page of decoded message in the air, slicing blades of sunlight descending from the windows. "Then we are agreed," Lakin smiled. "A very strange effect. Something makes the nuclear spins relax. Bing! Like that. Spontaneous resonance." "That's crap." Gordon had thought they were really homing in on the point, and now this old song and dance came up. "It's a simple statement of what we know. But how do you explain this?" He waved the message again. "I do not," Lakin shrugged elaborately. "I would not even mention it if I were you."
"Until we understand it..."
"No.
We do understand enough. Enough to talk in public about spontaneous resonance."
Lakin began a technical summary, ticking off the points on his fingers with a precise gesture. Gordon could see he had grilled Cooper thoroughly. Lakin knew how to present the data, which quantities to plot, how the figures in a paper could build in a very convincing case. Spontaneous resonance would make an interesting paper. No, an exciting one. When Lakin was finished and had sketched out the scientific arguments, Gordon said casually, "Half of you..." Lakin grimaced.
"I've humored you quite a bit, Gordon. For months.
It is time to admit the truth." "Uh-huh. What is it?"
"That your techniques are still faulty."
"How?"
"I do not know."
He shrugged, dipping his head and raising his eyebrows again. "I cannot be in the laboratory constantly.
We have been able to array the resonant signals..."
"So they seem to say something," Lakin smiled tolerantly.
"They could say anything, Gordon, if you fool with them enough. Look." He spread his hands. "You remember from astronomy, the fellow Lowell?"
"Yes,"
Gordon said suspiciously.
"He discovered the canals on Mars.
Saw them for years, decades. Other people reported seeing them. Lowell had his own observatory built in the desert. He was a rich man. He had excellent seeing conditions there. The man had time and fine eyesight, so he discovered evidence of intelligence."
"Yeah, but," Gordon began,
"the only mistake was that he had the wrong conclusion. The intelligent life was on his side of the telescope, not the Mars end. His mind had imposed order. His own intelligence was tricking him."
"Yeah.
Yeah," Gordon said sourly. He couldn't think of a counter-argument.
Lakin these things, knew more stories, had a subtle instinct for maneuver.
"I propose that we not turn ourselves into Lowells. Publish the spontaneous resonant stuff right away," Gordon said, trying to think.
"Yes.
We have to finish the NSF proposal this week. We can feature the spontaneous resonance material. I can write it up from the notebooks in such a way that we can use the same manuscript for a paper to physical review letters." "What good will it do to send it to PRL?
Gordon asked, trying to decide what his reaction was.
"In NSF, we can list it in the reference pages as, quote, submitted to PRL. That puts an earmark on it. Says it is a work of foremost quality. In fact..."
He pursed his lips, judging, peering over imaginary horn rims.
"Why not say, to be published in PRL? I am certain they will accept it, and to be published carries more weight."
"It's not true."
"It soon will be."
Lakin sat down behind his desk and leaned forward on it, hands clasped together.
"And I tell you frankly that without something interesting, something new, the grant is in trouble."
Gordon looked at him steadily for a long moment. Lakin got up and resumed pacing.
"No, of course it was only a thought. We will say submitted to, and that will have to do it."
He circumnavigated the office with a measured step, thinking. He stopped before the blackboard with its crude sketches of the data.
"A very odd effect, and a credit to its discoverer. You.
Isaac, Gordon said carefully, I'm not going to drop this.
Fine.
Fine, Lakin said, taking Gordon's arm. Throw yourself into it. I'm sure the business with Cooper will resolve itself in time. You should arrange the date of his doctoral candidacy exam, you know. Gordon nodded absently. To set out on a full research program for the thesis, a student had to pass the 2-hour oral candidacy examination. Cooper would need some coaching. He tended to freeze up if more than 2 faculty members were within earshot, a remarkably common effect among students. I'm glad we have this settled, Lakin murmured. I'll show you a draft of the PRL paper on Monday. Meanwhile, he glanced at his watch, is starting. Gordon tried to concentrate on the colloquium lecture, but somehow the thread of the argument kept eluding him. Only a few rows away, Murray Gell-Mann was explaining the eightfold way scheme for understanding the basic particles of all matter. Gordon knew he should be following the discussion closely, for here was a genuinely fundamental question. The particle theorists already said Gell-Mann should get the Nobel for this work. He frowned and shifted forward in his seat, peering at Gell-Mann's equations. Someone in the audience asked a skeptical question, and Gell-Mann turned, always smooth and unperturbed, to counter it. The audience followed the exchange with interest. Gordon remembered his senior year at Columbia when he had first begun attending the physics department colloquia. He had noticed an obvious feature of the weekly meetings, one he never heard talked about. Anyone could ask a question, and when he did, all attention of the audience turned to him. If there were several exchanges between lecturer and questioner, all the better. And a questioner who caught the speaker in an error was rewarded with nodding heads and smiles from those around him. All this was clear, and it was doubly clear that no one in the audience prepared for the colloquia. No one studied for them. The colloquium topic was announced a week in advance. Gordon began reading up on the topic and taking down a few notes. He would look up the speaker's papers, with special attention to the conclusions section, where authors usually speculated a bit, threw out blue-sky ideas, and occasionally took indirect slams at their competitors. Then he would read the competitors' papers as well. This always generated several good questions. Occasionally, such a question, innocently asked, could puncture a speaker's ideas like a stiletto. This would create a murmur of interest in the audience and inquiring glances toward Gordon. Even an ordinary question, if well delivered, created the impression of deep understanding.
This ends side 1 of cassette 4. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.